Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Going to read this evening from Canto 3, Chapter 26, Texts 6 and Part of 7. This section of Srimad Bhagavatam is Lord Kapila Dev instructing Devahuti in the fundamentals of Sankhya Yoga, or Sankhya philosophy. The title of the chapter is Fundamental Principles of Material Nature. And the previous chapter is a very ecstatic chapter about devotional service. The glories of devotional service. The scene is Karva Muni has left home, as was promised to him that he could do by his father-in-law, Swayambhuva Manu, when he came to meet Kardava Muni in the forest. And the request was to Kardava Muni, please accept my daughter as your wife. Kardava Muni agreed on a condition. The condition was, when we have a son who is old enough to take responsibility for your daughter, then I will return to the forest in a renounced position. So that's what happened. The section describing Devahuti's marriage with Kardava Muni and the full range of his teachings spans something like 12 chapters. It's a big section of the Bhagavatam. It gets more attention than Ram's Leela gets in Bhagavatam. In part because there's a great deal of instruction. Kapila Dev, Lord Kapila Dev, is a Shaktyavesh avatar. You'll find reference to this in Chapter 7 of Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Prabhupada writes towards the end of the chapter. And in Laghu Bhagavatamrita, which is a book by Rupa Goswami, a companion literature to Srimad Bhagavatam, Laghu Bhagavatamrita, the book is specifically designated or dedicated to describing one of the six questions of the Bhagavatam, the forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. It's one of the six questions. So that's the whole book. It summarizes chapter 3, the section that gives the Bhagavatam section that gives the incarnations, reiterates and expands that information, and then goes deeper into the categories of incarnations. As we know from Lord Chaitanya's teachings to Sanatan Goswami, there are six categories of avatars. Rupa Goswami breaks it into subcategories of those categories, and then subcategories of those subcategories. It's like very thorough. And I won't go into it, but it's the specific type of Shaktivesh avatar that Kapila Dev represents is where he doesn't present the fullness of the opulences of Bhagavan, but specifically he appears, those in this category, Dattatreya is another example, they appear as ascetics, yogis that are very renounced, and they not only exhibit renunciation, they teach renunciation, and they give very, very, very comprehensive, deep scriptural teachings or philosophical or spiritual teachings. And Kapila Dev is one of them, one of that category. He's speaking to his mother, and the goal of his speaking to his mother is not to have his mother become an ascetic. She already did that when she first married Kardamuni, because Kardamuni was living as an ascetic. She was a princess, royal, not just royal, she was the daughter of the king of the universe. That's like, you can't get more royal than that. And she left that palatial, opulent life to live the life of the humble servant of her husband, who was an ascetic, Kardamuni. And Kardamuni is a direct son of Lord Brahma, born directly from the body of Lord Brahma. A yogi who was so, or Muni who was so qualified in devotion that the personality of God had appeared before him, even before he was married, and said, you're going to have a personality of Godhead as your son. I will appear as your son. So he got married. So as his son, personality of Godhead appeared, the same who appeared before him in the forest. So she was already living the life of an ascetic, serving her husband. The teachings that Kapila Dev gives are not a teachings of asceticism. They're the teaching of, ultimately, they're the teaching of pure devotional service. But this is in the very beginning of Satya Yuga, the first of the Manus, and the 14 Manus in each of the Manvantar periods, each day of Brahma. Swayambhuva Manu is the first, and Devahuti is the son of, or daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, and Kardamuni, Kapila Dev is the son of her. So it's very early in Satya Yuga. And what is the process for spiritual perfection in Satya Yuga? Meditation, right? Right. Meditation. You were just meditating. It did disturbing your meditation. So it looks like he's giving a process of meditation. And there is a process of meditation, but it's a meditation that culminates in pure devotional service. We also have a process of meditation. People ask us, in your Hare Krishna movement, do you have a process of meditation? And one answer is, huh? What do you mean? So we do. Manmana. Fix the mind on Krishna. It's meditation. Whether we're stirring the sweet rice or sweeping the floor or worshiping the deity or doing the accounting or doing your housework or going to the office. We're meditating on Krishna, chanting the holy name. In Satya Yuga, the process was more formal type of meditation. But that formal type of meditation had a parallel track. And that is meditation on what? Withdraw the mind from what and place the mind on what else? And if you don't have devotion, then the what else is nothing. Meditate on nothingness. You know, in Zen, they have koans. Have you heard that phrase before? Koans? What is the sound of one hand clapping? Meditate on that. And when you reach the stage of satori, like enlightenment, you'll know what is the sound of one hand clapping. That's the object of meditation. It's nothingness is the answer. So meditate on nothingness. Even meditation upon the undifferentiated Brahman is somethingness. It's close to nothingness. Unvariegated. So what Krishna's pronouncement in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita is that's very difficult for those who are embodied. But try to meditate on nothingness. And what's the objective of meditation on nothingness? To rid oneself of all suffering. So Devahuti, after Kardamuni left, as was promised to him by his father-in-law, there is Kapiladev, an incarnation of the personality of Godhead, very qualified son, no question about that, and of age sufficient to take care of his mother. He left. So there's Devahuti looking at her son saying, "You're my only shelter." And in this situation where I've just, that person who I've served so faithfully for years and 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 years, he's gone. Now that may come at death, or it may come in this manner as the husband goes on to the next stage of his life. So she turned to her son and said, "I'm attached." She didn't detail those attachments, but it's obvious for those that know what attachment feels like. She's attached to the bodily concept of life. And because of that, I'm suffering. And my mind is pained. Please instruct me how to get free from this suffering. And that's the beginning part of chapter 25, and then he indicates devotional service as the means. He describes devotional service a bit, then he describes how devotional service is made possible. And we know how devotional service is made possible, right? How do you become a devotee? By meeting a devotee. By someone who is carrying bhakti, and they spill a little bhakti on you from their bhakti vessel. They give you their mercy. That's how you become a devotee. So he speaks of sadhu sangha, as Rupa Goswami has described. Adau shraddha tata sadhu sangha. Bhajana kriya anarta nirvritti syat. So 25, big part of it is sadhu sangha. In fact, those that are relishers of the Bhagavatam have identified There's 8 verses, Sadhu Sangastaka. Which I'm going to be giving a seminar in about a month, just on those verses, on these that chapter 25 teaching, on the glories of devotee association. Who is a sadhu? What are the effects of associating with a sadhu? How to associate with a sadhu? And then the glories of devotional service that flows from sadhu sangha, the bhajana kriya part. Then up to perfection. Having described that in chapter 25, Kapila Dev then goes back to the beginning and says, now I'm going to describe to you in further detail different features of the Absolute Truth. And we know different features of the Absolute Truth from the first canto. Chapter 3. Vedanta tat tattva vidas tattvam yaj gyanam advayam prameti paramatmiteti bhagavaniti shabdyate. Those are aspects of the Absolute Truth. There's other ways, as Kapila Dev shows here, to reveal various aspects of the Absolute Truth. He reveals it in the form of tattvas. And he starts with jiva tattva. What's the living entity? Describes that. Vishnu tattva, the supreme living entity, describes that. And then he goes into describing Prakriti, another tattva. And that's where we are. He says that by this knowledge, I'll read what he says exactly. I shall explain that knowledge unto you by which the knot of attachment to the material world, knots, plural, the knots of attachment to the material world are cut. We know this from the first canto also. The strong, how so strong, identification of spirit with matter, or false ego, our dear friend, our best friend, our false ego. Devahuti isn't lacking in knowledge. She's taking the position like Arjuna takes the position, of one who's bewildered. She asks wonderful questions like a bewildered person should ask, but doesn't know how to ask because they're bewildered. And Kapila Dev smiles mildly. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, he's thinking, Kapila Dev is thinking, how is this possible? That you're influenced by false ego and bewildered by Maya, and you're my mother. And I'm the personality of Godhead. That's not your position. But anyway, because you're asking these things, it must be for the benefit of others, so I'll give the answers. Like that, he's thinking and then speaking. So, she has knowledge like we have knowledge. Our knowledge is up here. And where we are is somewhere down here. And there's this big gap between what we know and where we are. Right? Proof. Pick up your bead bag tomorrow morning and start chanting. And you know what the glories of the holy name are. And then there's how you're chanting the holy name. there's what we know, and there's where we are, and there's this big gap. And she wants to close the gap. And a sincere devotee wants to close the gap. Not just know more, but close the gap, become spiritually elevated, connected. That's what she wants. And she knows that her son is the connector. She knows that her son is the personality of Godhead, not just her son. She knows that her real identity is spirit soul. But she also is expressing, at least, that she feels the pull of material identification, material consciousness, thinking in terms of family, comfort, home, society, etc. So she's expressing the gap and asking him to close the gap, and so he's doing that for her so that he can do that for us. That's how we should take it. So he's saying this knowledge can cut the knots of attachment to the material world or material consciousness and transform it into spiritual consciousness. So we know very well, because we've heard it a zillion, quadrillion times, knowledge alone is not enough. It's not just knowledge, but when he's speaking knowledge, it's another kind. It's realized transcendental knowledge. Or it's the knowledge that's the mature fruit of a mature bhakta. The knowledge of a sadhu. And the knowledge of a realized soul cuts that false ego is the misidentification of the soul with matter. And the next tattva he discusses is the... Well, he didn't do that. He discusses the Vishnu tattva, the supreme soul, distinguishing the individual soul from the supreme soul, distinguishing this from that, because that's what intelligence does. Makes discriminations between this and that, one thing and another thing. When intelligence isn't... Like Prabhupada gives the example of a motor mechanic. Somebody's car stalls on the highway. They pull it off to the side. They open up the hood and they're looking under the hood and they can't figure out what's going on. And the mechanic comes along, he touches something, vroom, vroom, it's starting. It's not magic. It's knowledge. He knows this from that and this, and vroom, vroom, now it works. So, there's material knowledge and there's spiritual knowledge. And Kapila Dev is not giving motor mechanics, he's giving spiritual knowledge. How to connect the soul to the supreme soul. What's the distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul? He describes many things. Then he describes the, as the heading of the chapter is, fundamental principles of material nature. So what's prakriti? Tattva. It's another subject, just like in the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, there are five subject matters. These are also tattvas. Right? You with me? Five subject matters in the introduction to Bhagavad Gita. If you understand these five, you understand Bhagavad Gita. So he's going now into one of those, prakriti. It's one of the five, material nature. And the relationship of that material nature with the one whose nature it is. Nature implies a person. Whose nature? So the Supreme Lord has a particular energy we call material nature in English, prakriti, and he's Purusha. What's the relationship between Prakriti and Purusha, besides the enjoyer, the enjoyed, and the enjoyer? It says specifically that he accepts that which is in an unmanifest state. He makes it manifest from the avyakta to the vyakta state, from the pradhan state to the creation state. The Lord causes remotely, he causes creation to come into being. He doesn't run around and do like these people that construct buildings do. They take forever to build these buildings or build the highways. He doesn't do that kind of sudra work. He simply desires by his another potency, his icha shakti. The word is used, yadrichchaya. Built within that is icha, desire. A causeless desire. There's nothing that causes him, now it's time, you got a desire like this. Okay. Then the bell rings and he desires. Okay, let's have creation. There's no causation. He's fully independent. Yet from the fullness of his independence, he brings about the manifest state of the dormant material energy. And there's a purpose behind it also that's identified. The purpose is to provide the living entities, that other tattva that was described, an opportunity to overcome their big boo-boo, the big mistake. The mistake that says, I've got free will and I want to be an independent enjoyer. Big mistake. And to help rectify that mistake so that they won't desire like that, they won't misuse their free will further in that way, the material world is created. One of the purposes of creation. In order for that to happen, for that corrective purpose to happen, but at the same time, the other is to fulfill the living entity's illusory wish to be independent enjoyers, built within, listen very carefully, built within Prakriti is a kind of whammy power. that which covers knowledge. So you can't really know who you are or what's going on or what's what. Because in order to be an independent enjoyer, you have to be under that kind of a whammy. Maybe that's a word you don't know, an English word. Illusion. The Sanskrit word is jnana guhaya. It's a covering feature, similar to what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. There are four types of people that don't surrender unto me, 7th chapter Bhagavad Gita. And one of them is Mayaya Paritagyana, those who have knowledge that is stolen away by illusion. That's this one. Jnana Guhaya. So someone that has a big degree or is recognized in the world as being a very intelligent person that still thinks in terms of the body as the self and thinks of himself as the doer of activities. Their knowledge is taken away by this Prakriti. Kapila Dev is describing. These are like building blocks of how Krishna builds the kingdom of Maya. Like technology. If you want to build the kingdom of Maya, here's how you can do it. You have to have this component over here that can cover the knowledge of living entities. I'm going to back up a little bit because it's important. just a simple definition of Sankhya. What's going on is he's laying out Sankhya for his mother, for us. Persons not so qualified. That's us. Sankhya is analyzing matter and spirit. The distinction between the two. Just like there are three places in Bhagavad Gita where there's Sankhya sections. Chapter 2, from where Krishna begins his instruction to text 38. Because it's differentiating between the soul and what is not the soul, between the self and what is not the self, between spirit and matter. That's Sankhya. Then again in chapter 7, there's a few verses where Krishna is just saying, here's the separated eight material elements, energies. Aside from them, there's the superior, aparaprakriti. And then I am the controller of both, matter and spirit. You know those verses, 7th chapter. That's a little mini Sankhya section. Chapter 13 is a more expanded Sankhya section. Krishna doesn't call it Sankhya, but that's what it is. He calls it in the second chapter. This is Sankhya Yoga. But in chapter 13, Arjuna asks about six subject matters. The last six chapters of Bhagavad Gita are not introducing something new. It's expanding in deeper detail something that's already been presented. And the first of those last 16 chapters is chapter 13. So chapter 2 is Sankhya, and chapter 13 is a more expanded version of Sankhya. You with me? So he asks it in the form of a question. Three pairs of two. Gyanam and Gayam, knowledge and the object of knowledge. Prakriti and Purusha, field of activities. Material nature and the enjoyer of material nature. And Kshetra and Kshetragya. So basically it's matter and spirit. In different ways, describe matter and spirit, please. Please present Sankhya in greater detail. So in one of those verses,
you have Bhagavad Gita,
chapter 16, text 6 and 7, Krishna is answering the question, what is material nature? And to describe what is material nature, he gives the 24 elements that are found in the Bhagavatam. In chapter 26, the chapter that we're going to be looking at. And here's a quiz question. In chapter 7, Krishna says there's eight separated energies. Bhumi, Rupa, Nalova, Yukamano, Bhutar, Eva, Cha, Ahankara. Eight. Dina, Prakritir, Ashtada. Eight. In the 13th chapter, there's 24. In Kapila Dev, there's 24. So which one is right? Is there a contradiction? Sounds like a contradiction. 8 and 24. That's a contradiction. Is it 8 or is it 24? And the answer is, they're both right, of course, because Krishna is presenting in the 2nd chapter, or 7th chapter, and the 13th chapter. It's just a different way of looking at the same thing. And if you go down a little bit, besides the numbers 8 and 24, you'll see how the 24 comes to be. And it's just categories of matter. So in that verse, chapter 13, verses 6 and 7, after giving the 24 elements, Krishna starts to describe other things that don't immediately appear to be from the 24 elements, such as desire and hate, happiness and distress, the aggregate, life symptoms and convictions. So what's that? Is that desire and hate, happiness and distress, life symptoms, convictions? As far as Sankhya is concerned, that's all in the realm of matter. It's not who we are. Even our convictions is not who we are. Our convictions can change. Our happiness and stress certainly change. And all those things that Krishna says in the beginning of chapter 2, that there are features of duality that arise from sense perception and are to be tolerated, honor and dishonor, heat and cold, duality, this and that, yin and yang. You know, there's whole theologies on yin and yang. That's all there is. It's just like move with the flow of yin and yang. And that's their theology. It's called Taoism. Material nature. The push and the pull of material nature. Just accept it. Become one with it. Be pushed and pulled. That's Taoism. According to what Krishna is saying here in chapter 13, if you read it carefully, that's not who we are. Those feelings that we feel, desires that we feel, sadness, happiness, all that stuff, it's not who we are. What is it? There's a key word, vikrants. It means mixing. Prabhupada would use the phrase permutations and combinations. That's a 50-cent word. Permutations. It's there are elements, and when the elements mix, they come up with all types of variety. It's the mixing of the elements that makes us feel this sometimes and feel that sometimes. And we're the same person. It's certainly the mind. But, you know, why the mind is going this way sometimes and that way sometimes? Sometimes you feel happy, sometimes you feel distressed. First of all, primordially, it's not who we are. So don't identify with it. But how does it happen? It's just vikrams. It's just the interactions of different of the 24 elements. With knowledge, you can be detached from that. And with devotion, with knowledge, you can be situated in your real identity. Well, that may be going on, but even that reduces, and in fact, Kapila Dev says to Devahuti, and it's true, it cuts the false identification with that. The metaphor that's used at times is the lotus flower. Not like a lily that grows right on the surface of the water, but the lotus grows on a stem above the surface of the water. So, supposing there's some wind and the water surface is agitated, but the lotus is up above the water and it's not agitated. The one whose consciousness is fixed in transcendental awareness, the world that we're moving about can be and is agitated by the modes of nature and is disturbed by their movements. And sometimes feeling very good, sometimes feeling very bad, like a child. You know, in one moment laughing and giggling, the next moment crying and wailing and whining and whoa, the next moment giggling and no stability. So the transcendentalist doesn't identify with either. There may be this or maybe that. The surface of the water may be rising or falling. We just don't identify with it. That capacity comes by transcendental fixing of your consciousness upon the Supreme Soul. That's what yoga is, bringing your consciousness to the Supreme. By bringing your consciousness to the Supreme, that's what yoga is, you can go beyond this duality of material existence. So, that's the phrase in Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, a different phrase, same message, just presented more comprehensively. Gunai Vichitarai, same message, by the variegatedness of the elements of Prakriti, the mixing of the elements of Prakriti. The classic example is the primary colors, yellow, red, and blue, mixed, three colors, make all possible colors. All possible colors come from three colors. All variegatedness comes from three. That's the principle, fundamental principle of material nature. It starts with three, and then it mixes. And then you get all variety. The problem isn't the variety or which particular type of variety is manifest now. It's the modes of nature. And they're mixing and are identifying with that. So that's what all this is, background, so we can do our verse for this evening. The verse begins Evam. Evam is in this way. So in this way is all of what I've said. In this way, this deluding potency, Jnana Guhaya, that, you know, this pillar looks very nice, elegant, doesn't look like it's conditioning me at all. It's just standing there, just dull matter and chair and, you know, and stuff. Prakriti, material nature. But that Prakriti also has a potency that is activated when the jiva, that's us, have a desire, let me be the enjoyer of Prakriti. And then the whammy starts. Then the deluding potency covers our real knowledge of who we are, because you have to have that covered in order to be the enjoyer of Krishna's energy. Thus, Evam, because of his forgetfulness, is how Prabhupada is translated. So we're already at the stage of Kapila's describing the living entity that actually is part and parcel of the Supreme, but turning attention away from the Supreme, facilitated by the Supreme Lord's arousing from slumber the avyakta state of Prakriti, and then Prakriti covers the living entity with this potency of forgetfulness. Because of his forgetfulness, the next domino effect is described. The transcendental living entity accepts the influence of material energy as his field of activities. Notice the commonness of the language with 13th chapter Bhagavad Gita. Kshetra and Kshetragya. Kshetra, field of activities. And Kshetragya, the knower of the field of activities. So, read it again. because of his forgetfulness, avidya guhaya, being covered by this deluding potency, the transcendental living entity accepts the influence of material energy as his field of activity. Not just the field, not just the object, but the influence of that. The deluding potency influence of that as his field of activity. And thus actuated, like now it's happening. It's the world of action. It's moving. The energy, material energy, is moving and it's influencing the soul, which is superior to matter. Now it's influencing the soul. He wrongly applies the activities to himself. He thinks that I'm the doer. Kartaham iti manyate. Very scientific, very practical, and very effective. Krishna knew what he was doing. He knew how to create a place where people would continue to think in an illusory way. Prabhupada writes in the purport, the forgetful living entity can be compared to a man who is under the influence of disease and has become mad, or to a man who is haunted by ghosts. I'll tell a little story. Well, first, in chapter 3, if you read chapter 3 of Nectar Devotion very carefully, Prabhupada is, in a summary way, stating what Rupa Goswami states in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu states that bhukti and mukti are like two witches that haunt and tease and taunt the living entity. Bhukti and mukti. Bhukti means material enjoyment. Mukti means liberation. Those that are the desire for material enjoyment, or the desire for let me out of here. These people are crazy. I want liberation. They're both compared to witches. The desire is a witch, tormenting the living entity that has their influence, or is under their influence. So the story is, you know from Chaitanya Charitamrita, those of you that have read it, that Ballabha Acharya was a contemporary of Lord Chaitanya. And there's some exchange between them that's mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Lord Chaitanya went to his home place, crossing to his home place on a boat. In the course of crossing in a boat, Lord Chaitanya went into a state of ecstasy and began dancing and calling loudly Krishna's name on the boat. You don't do that when you're in a boat. It was very dangerous. So he was trying to stabilize the boat. But Lord Chaitanya was in a state of ecstasy, so he couldn't be contained. And he had this, it wasn't pretense, it was an ecstasy. And he couldn't control it. So he understood this isn't an ordinary person. So in various ways, Ballabhacharya wanted to have Lord Chaitanya appreciate his scholarship, his erudition. And Lord Chaitanya purified him from that desire. What's not described in Chaitanya Charitamrita is that later, when the Goswami's followers of Lord Chaitanya were in Vrindavan, Ballabhachari was also in Vrindavan. And Rupa Goswami was in the process of writing Nectar Devotion, or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So he made this request. The request was, Ballabhachari, you're a great scholar, can you read through my text and tell me if you find any errors or flaws? Rupa Goswami did that with Sanatana Goswami. Do you see something that's an error? And Sanatana Goswami would point something out sometimes. So Ballabhacharya accepted that service. And when he read that passage from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he reported back to Rupa Goswami in one conversation one day, I think that's a little strong. Witches? The desire for liberation is a witch? You might want to tone the language down a little bit. Yeah, like editors do things like that. Jiva Goswami heard that Ballabhacharya was correcting Rupa Goswami's use of language. So privately, on the side, he had a conversation with Ballabhacharya and smashed him. Gave scriptural reference after scriptural reference after scriptural reference and logic and argument and scriptural reference, proving that it was the right use of the word. That bhakti and mukti are like witches and ghosts. So Ballabhacharya accepted. This is compelling. See, then he went back and told Rupa Goswami, your disciple, your student, Jiva Goswami, he explained to me in detail for several hours why comparing bhakti and mukti to ghosts and witches was appropriate. So you can leave that. That's good. Rupa Goswami called Jiva Goswami. Why have you done like this? I've asked him for some service and he's doing some service. He said, well, he's contradicting and your words are not flawed. Your words are perfect. And I just gave him scriptural reference to show I'm just defending your honor. And no. Let him do some service. It's a transcendental exchange. So, in the first line of the purport, Prabhupada is referring to that. He doesn't say Rupa Goswami writes in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He's writing for the world, the audience that doesn't know Rupa Goswami or anything. So he just says, the forgetful living entity can be compared to a man who is under the influence of disease and has become mad. That's in the Bhagavatam. Like a delirious person. Doesn't know where they are. And they may say so many things that's totally disoriented. You don't blame the person. Oh, this person's bad. They're just in a delirious state. Or, to a man haunted by ghosts, who acts without control and yet thinks himself to be in control. And that's exactly what Kapila Dev is saying. This influence of the material energy in this domino effect, and we're very familiar with this stage, where we think that we're the doer of activity. And to an average person, If you say, my dear sir, you're not the doer of your activity. Say, what are you talking about? First of all, he doesn't understand the meaning of the phrase to begin with. But once if you were to explain the meaning of the phrase, he would say, what are you talking about? Of course I'm doing things. I'm sitting here, and I have a desire. I want to get up and go to the door. So I get up and I go to the door. I'm doing things. If I was crippled, maybe I couldn't get up and go to the door. What do you say? I'm not doing anything. The explanation from Bhagavad Gita is it's being carried out by material nature. That's how Krishna sees things, and that's really what's going on. Events of this world are but permutations and combinations. They're transformations or variegated expressions of the modes of nature that are taking shape according to these bhukti and mukti, these witch-like desires of the living entity to enjoy or to become liberated from this realm of enjoyment. Neat little package, put a bow on it, and there it is. Material life, material consciousness. Under the influence of material nature, the conditioned soul becomes absorbed in material consciousness. In this consciousness, whatever is done under the influence of material energy is accepted by the conditioned soul as self-actuated. What does that mean, self-actuated? I did it. Kartaham. Self-actuated. Not only I did it, but then I'm causing other people to do things. But Krishna says very clearly in Bhagavad Gita, don't think like that. Never think of yourself as the cause of action. Never think of yourself as the cause of the result of action. And never think of yourself as inducing others to act, which is how everybody is thinking. Well, how else do you think if you don't think that? Krishna gives the answer. It's all being carried out by material nature. And we're just going along for the ride. Yantra Rudhani, Mayaya. We're a passenger in this machine of the material nature. So let's go back some steps. How do we get in this machine of material nature? Desiring to enjoy independently? That's discussed in earlier verses and purports. Misuse of free will, that's how we got here. Well, how do I get out? How do I properly use my free will? I want out. I want out. Let me out of here. That's another witch. Because we can't get out like that. Or doing something to get out. We have to do something because we're spirit soul. What do we do? It's a rubric. You know what those things are? Anyway, it's a little puzzle that you can't figure out. Just however many times you move the thing, move the thing, move the thing, move the thing, and it never works out. Never works out. But it can be worked out. With sadhu sangha, with proper direction and descending mercy. Actually, the soul in its pure state of existence should be in Krishna consciousness. When a person is not acting in Krishna consciousness, he just says it in reverse. He's understood to be acting in material consciousness. Consciousness cannot be killed, for the symptoms of living entity is consciousness. That was discussed earlier. Now it's being said again. The solution is not anesthetize the soul. Meditate on nothingness. It's not a solution because we're somethingness. We're conscious. So where do we direct our consciousness? direct your consciousness to that which is reality, with a capital R, or to Sat. Om Tat Sat. Okay, what's Sat? Now that's part of what Sankhya is. I just read the translation of the next verse and we'll end. Text 7. Material consciousness is the cause of one's conditional life, in which conditions are enforced upon the living entity by material energy. Although the spirit soul does not do anything and is transcendental to such activities, he is thus affected by conditional life. So Devahuti's question, like ours, is, help! What am I to do? I know this, and I'm down here. Help! How do I get out of this material consciousness? Part of the process that Kapiladeva is offering to Devahuti is knowing the difference between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness. What makes up material consciousness? Then you, once you understand the workings of it, at least you're in a stronger position to detach yourself from it. Jnana and Vairagya are a common couplet throughout the whole of Vedic literature. Knowledge is esteemed, even in the material world. People have knowledge. It's just one of those things. It's an opulence that people value. How many hours have any one of us, if we started adding up collectively, how many hours of education have we invested for knowledge? Wow, a lot of hours. Why? Because people value it. Commonly is the culture of avidya rather than the culture of vidya. So with this meditation through proper knowledge of who we are, that's part of the Sankhya philosophy, part of the Sankhya yoga process. It's detachment and then attachment to the Supreme, but being very clear what attachment to the Supreme is, rather than thinking it's nothingness, or go with the flow, or something, some mistake in conception, having a proper conception. Detachment and attachment to the Supreme. To be continued tomorrow morning. Any comments or questions?
Hare Krishna. You say that my bhakti, both jnana and vairagya, naturally come from bhakti. Does it mean understanding of the Sankhya philosophy is the result of bhakti and it cannot be understood apart from
it? Just say the last part again.
Does it mean that the Sankhya understanding here is possible only by bhakti?
Yes. The fruit of the Sankhya teaching, Sankhya yoga, Sankhya philosophy, the fruit of it is only possible through bhakti. Because the Sankhya, Lord Kapiladeva is not teaching become an armchair philosopher. Kapiladeva is teaching the means to become attached to the Supreme. And it's already in the previous chapter described specifically like that, bhakti. So this is a type or an approach to, a Satya Yuga approach to bhakti. But the elements of that Satya Yuga approach to bhakti certainly has its implications in Kali Yuga. Sambandha Gyan is still appropriate in Kali Yuga when it comes to chanting the holy name. Haridas Thakur says that in Harinam Chintamani. One can chant, but without proper Sambandha Gyan, they're not going to receive the proper fruit. So chanting is meant to be in tandem with proper Sambandha Gyan. The details and further details, so one may not become knowledgeable in all of the details. Just understanding those little verses in chapter 7, that's sufficient. The more detailed is to give support to the bhakti principle. But the bhakti principle stands on its own. And it's through the bhakti, conversely, it's through the bhakti principle that the knowledge of the components is given potency to help one in the bhakti process, or can help one in the achieving our ultimate destination. Say the question part again. Yeah, I got that part.
So, understand independent of the soul, or can you call it desires and how you can use it, presence of the soul for that implementation?
You said it again real fast, right at the critical phase. So, the eight are separate from desire and hate and emotions and feelings and all that stuff? No. It's a mix. Let's go through the. There's a model, and there's another model, and they both work. So, I'm not aware in the chapter 26 here, I'm not aware if whether or not Kapiladev says this mixes with that together with that and you get this emotion, this together with that, you get that emotion. But it's something like that. From a clinical or scientific or objective perspective. Going back to the eight, it's not fully delineated. The same principle would apply. The elements mix and you get emotions. There's another system. The system of Ayurveda, where there's three doshas instead of there's five elements, there's three doshas, and they mix, and then you get different emotions. There's a whole wing, a whole section of the study of Ayurveda where it, you know, describes psychological states and how to bring the balance of the doshas to bring a balance of a psychological state. If somebody has this emotion, it's something. The doshas mixing this way, and how to bring the balance. So, yes, but without the detail of, you know, this mixes with that gets a certain result. The principle is there, for sure. Because there's the eight, and then apart from that, aparayamitas tranyam bina prakriti me param. There's para prakriti besides that one. So these emotions and feelings and desires and hates and happiness and distress and honor and dishonor and hot and cold and up and down and light and dark and wet and dry and you name it, it's just different manifestations of those elements. It's distinct from us. But yes, in principle. Without the soul, matter doesn't move. In chapter 18, there's five factors of action. It's not just even the presence of the soul, but endeavor. Endeavor for happiness. But you know, what's happiness is according to the modes of nature. The soul being influenced by the modes of nature makes an endeavor in a particular way towards pleasure. Or happiness. But one man's food is another man's poison. One man's pleasure is another man's distress. Without the soul present, you don't have mixing. That's pradhan.
You mentioned about the influence, the living entity getting influenced by the of matter.
Yes.
And you also explained about how the different incarnations of the Lord and the various acharyas.
Turn this thing so I can hear.
You also mentioned about
the. Okay, turn it away, but I want to be able to hear. Turn it on. Turn it on. Go ahead. There we go. Magic.
These various incarnations that you spoke of, you came and spoke in different philosophies.
Your magic is fallible.
Shall I just speak about that?
Go ahead.
These personalities who are engaged in propounding the philosophy, expounding these teachings.
Yes.
They are incarnations of the Lord, a very exalted person.
Yes.
It seems a little strange to me that, it's difficult to understand how the covering of a tiny living entity with such great personalities working to deliver us is so difficult. Why is it like that? And Krishna himself desiring our deliverance, these great personalities taking so much effort, why is the deliverance of the living entity such a difficult task?
That's a nice question. Do you all understand the question? Krishna doesn't interfere with our free will. He's situated in our heart and he's prompting us from within our heart. He's standing before us in so many ways. But and giving instruction. But still, there's free will. And he doesn't interfere with that. We can elaborate, but that's the simple answer. So some people say, well, why doesn't he interfere with it? It's part of his qualification of love. I mean, I just had this exchange with somebody where that was their contention. Krishna obviously doesn't love me. Because I pray to him every day very intently, please protect me. And then I do these stupid things. And I get entangled and get attached. And, you know, it's obvious to me, Krishna doesn't love me. Hello. He doesn't interfere with your free will. He'll, you know, he hears your prayer, but he also is in your heart. And he knows this other thing that says, I want to enjoy independently. And he doesn't interfere. You could just shut me down and say, you know, no. Make another arrangement, please. Don't listen to my desire, that one. Listen to this one. I'm asking, but he doesn't love me because he lets me do that one. See, Lord doesn't interfere with free will. We can't blame our misuse of free will upon the Supreme Lord. So, even in Krishna's presence, or Lord Kapila's presence, or whoever's presence, a great personality's presence, empowered by Krishna, the answer is still maybe no. He doesn't interfere with that. He'll continue to say, well, please reconsider. Think of this. Please do that. Here's some suffering. Very stubborn obstinacy. Sometimes Prabhupada used that phrase. Anything else? Okay, now that the microphone is fixed, we're all done. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.